This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Nearly 80 of the countries represented over the weekend at the Summit on Peace of Ukraine agreed territorial integrity and the principles of international law and the UN Charter should be the basis for talks to end the Russian war in Ukraine.
Leaders from 101 countries and organizations wrapped up 2 days of discussion on ending Russia's war in Ukraine with a show of unity against Russian aggression. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called for a diplomatic solution to end the war.
War is not our choice. It's Putin's choice.
Russia was not invited, but just before the summit, President Vladimir Putin demanded that Ukraine withdraw from territory captured by Russia and abandon its goal of joining NATO. U.S. and other representatives at the summit saw this as an ultimatum, saying Russia has no intention of fostering peace or real negotiations.
Miroslava Gungadze, VOA News, Bergenstock Resort, Switzerland.
A U.S. special envoy visited Jerusalem Monday seeking to calm the situation on the disputed northern border with Lebanon and Israel. Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen.
Israel said tensions with the Iran-backed Hezbollah militia could lead to a larger conflict. Here's Israeli Army spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari.
Hezbollah is jeopardizing the future of Lebanon so that it can be a shield for Hamas.
U.S. Special Envoy Amos Hochstein's visit follows weeks of increasing exchanges of fire along the line between Israel and Lebanon, where Israeli forces have for months been engaged in a simmering conflict with Hezbollah that has continued alongside the war in Gaza.
South Korea's military says soldiers fired warning shots to repel North Korean soldiers who had temporarily crossed the rival's land border for the second time this month. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said around 20 to 30 North Korean soldiers engaged in unspecified construction work. This is VOA News. Russian President Vladimir Putin is thanking North Korea for supporting his actions in Ukraine and says the two countries would work together to overcome U.S.-led sanctions. Comments were published Tuesday as the Russian leader was heading to Pyongyang to meet with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. Their countries are deepening their alignment in the face of intensifying confrontations with Washington. Putin's comments appeared on North Korean state media hours before Putin expected arrival and international concerns about the two countries' expanding military cooperation. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said Monday that nearly two dozen NATO members will meet the alliance's target spending to defense this year, highlighting how allies have raised military spending since Russia seized Crimea from Ukraine in 2014.
This year, 23 allies will spend 2% of GDP or more on defense, which is twice as much as just 4 years ago.
Stoltenberg in Washington said the trend is increased military spending by NATO members was triggered by Russia's seizure of Crimea. NATO's defense spending has become highly contentious in recent years, particularly as former U.S. President Donald Trump accused Europeans of spending too little on their own security and relying on the United States for protection. An Indian man accused by U.S. prosecutors of orchestrating an unsuccessful plot to kill a Sikh separatist on American soil pleaded not guilty Monday to murder-for-hire conspiracy charges in a federal court in New York. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman.
Nikhil Gupta also was ordered detained during the hearing. U.S. federal prosecutors allege Gupta plotted with an Indian government official to kill Gurpatwant Singh Panun, a U.S. resident who advocated for a sovereign Sikh state in northern India. Last June, Gupta traveled to Prague from India and was arrested by Czech authorities. Video released on Monday by the Czech police appears to show two New York police officers escorting a handcuffed suspect at the airport in Prague. Czech Justice Minister Pavel Blažek said Gupta was extradited to the U.S. on Friday. The discovery of alleged assassination plots against Sikh separatists in the U.S. and Canada has tested relations with India. India's government denies involvement in such plots.
Reuters' Zachary Goldman. More than 75 million people in the United States are under extreme heat alerts as a heat wave moves eastward. The Mid-Atlantic and New England are likely to see highs in the 90s as the week progresses. Excessive humidity will make it even more oppressive. The U.S. last year saw the most heat waves consisting of abnormally hot weather lasting more than 2 days since 1936. Officials again are warning residents to take precautions. Much of the Midwest and Northeast are under heat warnings or watches, while much of U.S. swelters, late season snow was forecast for the Northern Rockies. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dissolved the six-member war cabinet.
With Mr. Gantz's decision to leave, I'm not sure that Prime Minister Netanyahu was left with a whole lot of other choices.
A record number of NATO allies are expected to reach the alliance's recommended defense funding amid the war in Ukraine.
Across Europe and Canada, NATO allies are this year increasing defense spending by 18%.
And a German charity has built a skate park in Namibia where youngsters with disabilities can practice.
Skateboarding has a fundamental lesson which teaches everybody, which is you fall, you get back up, and you never give up in whatever it is that you are pursuing.
Today is Tuesday, June 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strobe. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dissolved the six-member war cabinet in a widely expected move following the departure of centrist former general Benny Gantz from the government. White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby said on Monday Netanyahu was left with little choice.
The war cabinet was an internal domestic measure taken by the prime minister to better advise and provide him counsel on the war. We said at the time that we believed it was a worthwhile step, and we still hold by that. But with Mr. Gantz's decision to leave, I'm not sure that Prime Minister Netanyahu was left with a whole lot of other choices.
Netanyahu is now expected to hold consultations about the Gaza war with a small group of ministers, including Defense Minister Yoav Gallant and Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer, who had been in the war cabinet. VOA Steve Karish spoke with Linda Gradstein about what this could mean for the war in Gaza and how the Israeli public is reacting to Netanyahu's decision.
Well, it means that the decisions about the war will no longer be in this smaller forum of the war cabinet, which Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot, the two former chiefs of staff who pulled out of the government last week, were part of. And at least from all of the reports, they had a somewhat moderating influence on some of the decisions, at least. And Netanyahu's extremist partners, Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, could for now perhaps have more influence. Ben-Gvir very much wanted a seat on this war cabinet, and he said that now that, you know, there was now room since Gantz and Eisenkot had left, and then Netanyahu dissolved the war cabinet, which kind of could have been his message to Ben-Gvir that he actually doesn't want him on the war cabinet. Israeli officials said that the decisions will be made, Netanyahu and the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, and then will be taken to the security cabinet where Ben-Gvir and Smotrich do have seats.
Does the dissolution of the war cabinet portend any bigger changes to the government? I know you and I have spoken before about the Israeli public wanting to see elections sooner rather than later.
I think unless you're going to see hundreds of thousands of people coming into the streets, and the response of Netanyahu usually is, well, as long as there's a war going on, we can't go to new elections. So I don't think there are going to be new elections anytime very soon.
And speaking of the Israeli public and public opinion, how are they taking this news that the war cabinet has been dissolved? Are they seeing this as a failure of Netanyahu to keep it together, or rather a failure of the two that left to sort of get on board and get with the program?
So I think they're kind of mixed feelings. You know, there are the public support for Netanyahu is low. Two-thirds of the public says they don't have a lot of confidence in him. Among the Arab public, it's something like three-quarters. At the same time, this move was not really a surprise. You know, it was kind of expected that once they left, Netanyahu would dissolve the war cabinet. There does seem to be, however, an increasing sort of movement. Again, it's slow. It's not a huge movement yet, but of people saying, you know, that they want there to be new elections. A new poll that just came out today also said that 60% of the public support the latest ceasefire deal that's on the table that President Biden, you know, has released, saying it's an Israeli proposal and calling on the world to pressure Hamas. And basically, that would mean a ceasefire, an end to the war in exchange for the release of all of the hostages.
And speaking of ceasefire, it's not a total ceasefire, but what they're calling a tactical pause in fighting along a key route near the Kerem Shalom border crossing into Gaza. Can you tell us what's happening there, how large an area it is, and what we can expect to happen?
Well, yeah, there's something, this whole thing is a bit strange because the announcement came from the Israeli army, not from the government. And then Netanyahu in the cabinet meeting said, this is the first I've heard of it. But basically the army said that during the daytime hours from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m., they would pause operations along this corridor. So it's not a huge area, but it's a corridor that goes near the city of Rafah in order to allow more humanitarian aid to come in. Apparently, there are hundreds and hundreds of trucks that Israel has inspected and is allowing in.
So is this a tacit admission by the Israelis that there is a problem with humanitarian aid in Gaza and that they can, in fact, do more?
Well, yes, but, I mean, what Israel says is that if Egypt hadn't closed the Rafah side of the border, there wouldn't be an issue and that they're responding to that. Israel continues to maintain that there's enough aid coming in. They say the problem is the distribution by the UN, so it's not clear how this pause would help that issue of distribution. They also say that Hamas is stealing the aid. But I think there also is a recognition by Israel that whether or not it's Israel's fault, Israel's being blamed for the humanitarian situation there.
VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your reporting today.
Thank you, Steve.
Following Gantz's departure and Netanyahu's decision to dissolve the war cabinet, anti-government protesters converged on Jerusalem on Monday, calling for new elections in an effort to replace the Israeli prime minister. Opposition groups declared a week of street protests that include blocking highways and mass demonstrations. As issues with aid getting into Gaza remain rampant, Norway, who chairs the international donor group to the Palestinians and is a backer of the Palestinian Authority, has argued that funding cuts put the population of Gaza at risk. Norwegian Foreign Minister Espen Barth Eide said the Palestinian Authority could collapse in the coming months, citing a lack of funding, continuing violence, and the fact that 500,000 Palestinians are not allowed to work in Israel, and that there is no alternative to UNRWA.
The real solution to the drama of the Middle East must lie in a two-state solution, and in that we need to build the institutions of the Palestinian Authority, make it possible for them also to return to Gaza, and in that work, the work of the UN, and most importantly in this part of the world through UNRWA, is indispensable. It simply has to be able to work, and it has to be respected.
At a press conference with UNRWA chief Felipe Lazzarini, Eide said Norway would be topping up its contribution with 100 million Norwegian crowns, which is approximately $9.3 million U.S. President Joe Biden met with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg at the White House on Monday for a bilateral meeting, as Stoltenberg said that more NATO members will meet defense spending targets.
Across Europe and Canada, NATO allies are this year increasing defense spending by 18%. That's the biggest increase in decades. 23 allies are going to spend 2% of GDP or more on defense this year.
Biden said the alliance is facing one of the most consequential moments for Europe since World War II, as Ukraine battles Russian forces.
NATO was founded 75 years ago, and it's, I think the lessons we've learned then and by standing together to defend and deter aggression have been consequential.
Stoltenberg was in Washington for preparations for next month's NATO summit in the U.S. Capitol, a topic that he and Biden discussed as well. We're following these other stories from around the world. North Korean state media says Russian President Vladimir Putin will arrive in the country on Tuesday for a two-day visit. Putin's first trip to the country in 24 years comes amid international concerns about the two countries' expanding military cooperation. Putin is expected to meet with the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un for talks as they deepen their alignment in the face of separate, intensifying confrontations with Washington. A Russian court says the espionage trial in Russia of Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich Gershkovich will begin on June 26th and will be held behind closed doors. Gershkovich, a U.S. citizen, has been behind bars since his March 2023 arrest and faces 20 years in prison if convicted. The 32-year-old is accused of gathering secret information on orders from the CIA about Uralvagonzavod, a facility that produces and repairs military equipment, the prosecutor general's office said last week. The reporter, his employer, and the U.S. government deny the allegations. A cargo train collided with a passenger train in India's eastern state of West Bengal, killing at least 9 people and injuring dozens of others. Monday's accident took place in the Darjeeling district, a tourist spot nestled in the Himalayan foothills. A spokesperson for the Northeast Frontier Railway says 3 of the 9 dead were railway personnel. At least 50 people were hospitalized. The spokesperson said the driver of the cargo train, who was among the dead, disregarded a signal and caused the collision. The U.S. Supreme Court last week struck down a ban on gun accessories that allows many semi-automatic weapons to fire like machine guns. The decision keeps guns and gun owners at the center of this U.S. presidential campaign. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has our story.
Bump stocks are aftermarket additions that allow weapons to fire hundreds of bullets a minute. They were banned by then-President Donald Trump in 2018.
This morning, we also completed the process to issue a new regulation banning bump stocks.
Following a 2017 shooting at a music festival in Las Vegas that killed 60 people, the shooter used a bump stock to fire more than 1,000 rounds from a hotel window. Overturning that ban last week, the Supreme Court's conservative majority said the then-Trump administration overstepped its authority in outlawing bump stocks. The decision keeps guns a central campaign issue in this presidential election. The Trump campaign said Americans should respect the High Court's decision. On Friday, Trump told a birthday rally in Florida that his election will safeguard gun rights in the U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment.
We got to get people, gun owners, you're not going to have your gun very long if you don't, because they want to take everything away. They want to take your guns away. They want to take your ammunition away. They want to destroy the Second Amendment.
President Joe Biden's reelection campaign called on Congress to reinstate the bump stock ban. Vice President Kamala Harris.
When we think about the decisions voters are going to make in November, there's a clear contrast between where we stand and the former president. Let's not forget the former president literally said folks need to get over it as it relates to the gun violence issue in America. So let's take this seriously. Let's understand that we all have the ability to weigh in on this important issue.
Trump supporters in Congress back gun owners' rights to use bump stocks.
The bump stocks, if you will, is really just a brace for people who have arm injuries who still actively shoot. That doesn't mean that they're going to target citizens. It never has.
Biden supporters in Congress say the Supreme Court decision will lead to more loss of life.
Without a doubt, there'll be some future tragedy utilizing these bump stocks. And we will all ask ourselves, why is this necessary? Why do we have to live with this?
Nearly a third of Americans say they own a gun, according to the Pew Research Center. Before November's vote, the High Court is expected to rule on another gun issue, this one concerning gun rights for people who are under restraining orders for domestic violence. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope. Protests in Turkey are growing over Azerbaijani oil deliveries to Israel. Azerbaijani oil exports have continued to pass through a Turkish port, despite Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's recent announcement of a trade embargo against Israel because of its offensive in Gaza. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Protesters have been targeting Azerbaijan's supply of oil to Israel through the Turkish port of Ceyhan. Azerbaijan, a close ally of Israel, meets about 40% of Israeli oil needs, a trade that appears unaffected by Israel's war on Hamas. Protests of Turkish-Israeli trade have damaged President Recep Tayyip Erdogan politically. His AK party suffered substantial losses in local elections in March, and analysts say trade with Israel, along with Turkey's economic crisis, were major reasons why voters turned against him. Following his local election defeat, Erdogan imposed an Israeli trade embargo, boasting that Turkey was at the forefront of confronting Israel. But Erdogan has close ties with Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, and Azerbaijan's state energy company, Soka, is the biggest international investor in Turkey. Therefore, analysts say stopping Azerbaijani oil exports to Israel is difficult for the Turkish leader. There are other factors for Turkey to consider. Mehmet Ergüçü is an analyst at the London Energy Club, a grouping of government and energy sector leaders.
Azeri-Israeli relationship has been consolidated. It is a bulwark against Iran as well, in some regards. And therefore, Azeris, although I'm sure they are also unhappy with what's happening in Gaza as a result of the Israeli land forces attack, and they would probably impress on Erdogan not to go that far.
With protests in Turkey against Azerbaijani oil exports to Israel continuing, police are stepping up arrests against organizers, prompting more protests. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Australia and China will take steps to improve military communication to avoid incidents, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said after meeting Premier Li Qiang on Monday in the first visit to the country by a Chinese premier in 7 years. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan reports.
Albanese said after the pair's meeting on Monday, the countries will take steps to improve military communication. He told reporters he had raised out issues in the Pacific, a reference to Canberra's concern over Beijing's growing security ambitions in nearby Pacific islands.
Australia advocates that we should all work together to promote a regional balance where no country dominates and no country is dominated.
Li said the two countries would expand cooperation in energy and mining, and China would include Australia in its visa waiver program.
Just now, Prime Minister Albanese and I had a candid, in-depth and fruitful meeting and reached a lot of consensuses. We both agreed to uphold the right characterization of our bilateral relationship and consolidate its momentum of improvement and development. We reaffirm our commitment to defining this relationship as a comprehensive strategic partnership, to mutual respect and trust, and to viewing and handling this relationship in a positive attitude.
As Li arrived in Canberra on Monday morning, protesters and supporters gathered on the lawn outside Parliament House, where there was a heavy police presence. The Chinese premier's four-day visit will include a business roundtable in the iron ore mining state of Western Australia. Australia is the biggest supplier of iron ore to China, and China has invested in Australian mining projects. The visit spotlights whether Australia will continue to accept high levels of Chinese investment in its critical minerals sector, as Western security allies push to reduce reliance on Beijing for the rare earths vital to electric vehicles.
That was Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan. While China and Australia take steps to improve communication, White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby said on Monday the U.S. finds reports of a Chinese vessel and a Philippine supply ship colliding near the disputed Spratly Islands in the South China Sea troubling.
This kind of behavior is provocative, it's reckless, it's unnecessary, and it could lead to misunderstandings and miscalculations that could lead to something much bigger and much more violent. It's imperative that the rightful legal maritime claims by the Philippines are respected by the PRC and by everybody else for that matter.
The U.S. State Department on Monday condemned what it called escalatory and irresponsible actions by China in the South China Sea on Sunday and reaffirmed its support for the Philippines. China's Coast Guard said a Philippine supply ship deliberately and dangerously approached a Chinese ship, resulting in a slight collision, a charge Manila has rejected. In Namibia, German charity Skate Aid has built a skate park on the National Institute for Special Education campus. Here, young learners with disabilities can practice a sport Skate Aid says encourages empowerment, socializing, and having fun. Vitalio Angula reports from Windhoek, Namibia.
Backsides, frontsides, and kick turns are just some of the tricks 19-year-old Zeka Shikumba has learned over the years. Shikumba, who is partially blind, began skateboarding in 2019, along with other children with disabilities at Namibia's National Institute for Special Education. He says he was not born like this. Eye cancer caused his vision loss.
I was not born like this. I had cancer before. Cancer is the one that caused my vision. I actually had eye cancer before, and that was in 2010 when it started, when the cancer started.
Shikumba says he relies on light, sound, and shadows to detect the different obstacles in the skate park. He is aware of the risk of falling and hurting himself, but he says this does not deter him. Tangeni Hamukoshi is a coach with SkateAid, the German charity that built the skate park. He gives lessons and also provides safety gear to the kids at the school. He says skateboarding has a fundamental lesson for everyone.
You fall, you get back up, and you never give up in whatever it is that you are pursuing.
About 400 learners with various physical and cognitive challenges attend the Namibia Institute for Special Education. Emily Shade, a life skills teacher, is in charge of sports at the Institute School of the Visually Impaired.
There are a lot of learners that are really interested and they are doing well. So that just proves that it doesn't mean that when you are blind, you cannot do anything.
Shikumba dreams of becoming a champion skater someday. And both his coach and life skills teacher believe that with more practice and more opportunities, he and other kids at the school will be able to compete at international games for learners with disabilities. Vitalio Angula, VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Alexis Drobe.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Russian authorities announced they will try American journalist Evan Gershkovich on charges of espionage. The trial will take place in the city of Yekaterinburg, where in 2023, Gershkovich was initially detained while on a reporting trip. Despite having been accredited by Russia's foreign ministry to work as a journalist, Gershkovich has been held for over a year in the notorious Lefortovo prison in Moscow. Gershkovich, his employer, the Wall Street Journal, and the United States government have vigorously denied the charges against him. The U.S. government has designated him as wrongfully detained. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said there is absolutely zero credibility to Russia's charges.
We have been clear from the start that Evan has done nothing wrong. He should never have been arrested in the first place. Journalism is not a crime. The charges against him are false, and the Russian government knows that they are false. He should be released immediately.
Spokesperson Miller said the United States will continue to work every day to bring home Evan Gershkovich, as well as American citizen and former Marine Paul Wheeler, who has been unjustly detained in Russia for more than 5 years. At the release of the State Department's most recent human rights report, Secretary of State Antony Blinken deplored the detentions of both men.
Governments like Russia also arbitrarily detain foreign nationals for political purposes, using human beings as bargaining chips. Paul Whelan, Evan Gershkovich, and every unjustly held individual deserves to go free. The United States and our many partners will keep working every day to reunite them with their families and to hold accountable governments that engage in this deplorable practice.
Speaking at a recent congressional hearing, U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs, Roger Carstens, also underscored the need for a collective response to the challenge of so-called hostage diplomacy. The nature of this problem is global and so, therefore, should be the solution, Special Envoy Carstens said. We are confident that if we get a critical mass of partners together to raise the cost of using foreign nationals as bargaining chips, we will be able to effectively deter bad actors and end arbitrary detention as a tool of diplomacy.
That was an editorial reflecting the